Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
On Tommy McNeil reporting, President Trump has criticized the federal judge who temporarily blocked his ban on travel to the U.S. from seven predominantly Muslim countries, warning that the ruling will allow what he called bad people into the U.S.
I will never forget that my responsibility is to keep you, the American people, safe and free. That's why last week I signed an executive order to help keep terrorists out of our country. The executive order establishes a process to develop new vetting and mechanisms to ensure those coming into America love and support our people, that they have good intentions.
And a U.S. appeals court today rejected the Trump administration's request to immediately reinstate the travel ban. Demonstrators took to the streets of many U.S. cities as well as cities in other countries. This is one of the protesters who was outside the U.S. embassy in London.
I think it's ridiculous. Like, so many of my friends are Muslim, and I don't agree with that at all. How can you base someone on their religion not to come to the country? Not all Muslims are terrorists. That's not true. It's not the religion. It's not the religion. It's their ideology, and that's not right.
In the meantime, President Trump continues to have phone conversations with world leaders. He spoke with Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko, seeking to reassure him of continued U.S. support as government forces and pro-Russia rebels battled near the Russian border. A Pakistani security official says at least 13 people have been killed in an avalanche that buried five homes following heavy snowfall in the country's north. That avalanche struck a town where rescuers have retrieved 13 bodies. There are still efforts underway to reach any remaining survivors. This is VOA News. French judicial sources say the man suspected of attacking French soldiers outside the Louvre Museum in Paris is so far refusing to speak with investigators. Meanwhile, the father of the suspect has told the Associated Press his son is not a terrorist. The Louvre Museum is open Saturday morning, less than 24 hours after the knife-wielding man was shot by soldiers. Abdullah Al-Hamimi's condition was markedly improved Saturday. That's according to the Paris prosecutor after having been shot four times. He reportedly yelled Allahu Akbar as he attacked soldiers outside the museum, injuring one of them. A top Iranian Revolutionary Guard commander says Tehran has conducted missile and radar exercises this weekend after the Trump administration imposed new sanctions on Iran for a ballistic missile test it conducted last week. U.S. Defense Chief James Mattis called Iran the single biggest state sponsor of terrorism in the world. Jordan says it has carried out airstrikes against Islamic State targets in southern Syria. Drones and precision-guided munitions killed and wounded an unspecified number of IS militants. Pro-Western Jordan has carried out such strikes before as part of a U.S.-led alliance against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. After mass protests that rocked the country for days, Romania's government has announced it will repeal a highly controversial emergency decree that decriminalizes official misconduct. Dudu Florin was one of the protesters.
It took them a couple of days to make this step aside. I'm not considering a fully step behind because there is some damage still in the legal papers they put in the official gazette. And it is already a huge legal debate on the real effects and the consequences of what they have voted and in the government and what they have published in the official gazette. However, it's important that they understood Romania is a strong democracy. People are in the street. And you cannot avoid doing the right thing.
And the government expected to hold an emergency meeting to withdraw that decree, which has sparked the biggest protest in Romania since the end of communism in 1989. Some protesters have been out in the streets of Bucharest in their tens of thousands. Well, it is safe to say that history could be made tonight in the U.S., when the New England Patriots face the Atlanta Falcons in Super Bowl 51 in Houston, Texas. The Patriots are appearing in their ninth American-style football championship. That's more than any other franchise in pro football history. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Yeah, damaged in all these offices, and Washington is one office where the activists think they were very, very loyal to Yahya Jammeh.
The Gambian Embassy in Washington, D.C. replaces Yahya Jammeh's portrait with President Adama Barrow's.
Our hope was that through the Nairobi Declaration of 2013, this problem would be solved between the two parties, mainly the C-23 and the government in Kinshasa. It has not been the case.
Congolese M23 rebel leader Sultan Makenga disappears in Uganda.
Soyons un, restons unis.
He says Cameroonians should solidly be united and remember all those who have died as a result of Boko Haram atrocities.
And Cameroonian President Paul Biya makes a rare public appearance. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Gambian Embassy in Washington, D.C. has replaced the portrait of Yahya Jammeh with President Adama Barrow's. It comes after a video of a similar replacement at the Gambian Permanent Mission at the United Nations went viral on social media. Meanwhile, President Barrow has sacked the head of intelligence, among other changes, since his return to the capital, Banjul. For the latest development in the Gambia, I reached Fatou Camara, Jammeh's former press secretary, who now runs her own news media organization.
Yeah, Jammeh is in all these offices, and Washington is one office where the activists think they were very, very loyal to Yahya Jammeh. So if we got to a point where they replaced his portrait with the one of Adama Barrow, and now we can see that they're open to the activists here that they were not talking to. So that's a very good development that many of us welcome. That now the doors to that embassy are open to every Gambian, irrespective of their political beliefs. So it's a good development.
How are Gambians reacting to the decision of President Adama Barrow to reinstate Ambassador Fay after the same ambassador urged former President Yahya Jammeh to step down, which of course led to his firing by Jammeh alongside 12 others?
Well, you know, of course, people have different opinions about it. Some people are like, oh, they served Jammeh, they should not be there again. But if you look at it this way, he is a Gambian as well, and he works for Gambia. He does not work for Jammeh. So many Gambians also see it that way, that it is good that they're not doing no witch hunting. They're not saying, oh, this person was with Jammeh, we're not going to employ them. We're all Gambians, if you look at it that way. So, you know, now we're going to see how the embassy is going to operate. Because when Jammeh was there, you know, he's a dictator. So he was dictating everything to them. Anybody he does not like, that person would feel that they don't have to be near that embassy. Because when they go over there, they may not have what they need. But now that Jammeh is not there and Jammeh is working towards a democracy, the onus now is on Sheikh Omar Faye. Many of us welcome the development that he is back in that office. But now we're going to see how he's going to operate that embassy now.
Let me ask you about President Yahya Jammeh's decision to go into exile after coming under heavy pressure militarily and diplomatically. I heard he emptied the coffers of public funds, and the current administration is now struggling to pay public sector workers.
Well, Yahya Jammeh going into exile is not something that many Gambians want. Because there is a guy who ruled that country for 22 years, and he intimidated a lot of people and traumatized many of our people. That's why I always say, you know, Gambians are really, you know, we still live in fear, because some people believe. Until now, some are saying, how about if he shows up one day? So what people wanted was for him to be in the country so he can face trial over there. Now that he's away, many believe he could come back, which, you know, I don't even know if that could happen. Maybe there is no possibility of that. But again, that's how some people are thinking. So him being in exile kind of brings that mixed feeling for everyone. But again, Sometimes we'll be told that, you know, now the world is a global village. Wherever he is, when it is time for him to face that persecution, they can always get hold of him. So we're hoping that that happens. So yes, I understand there's a lot of financial difficulties because Jammeh took everything with him and also was trying to ship his cars and other valuable belongings and stuff. But I'm sure they will be able to recover from that because they had a meeting with EU, and I understand the money that was frozen that was supposed to be given to Jammeh will be released to the Barrow government. And also, you know, we're getting word that some of the donors are ready to come forward and help them. I have no doubt in my mind that he's going to have the support of the world. One thing they also have to work on is try to see how to get Jammeh so that the many Gambians who still live in fear would be comfortable that the situation is under control.
You were one time Jammeh's press secretary. How was it like working for Yahya Jammeh in close proximity?
Well, you see, with Jammeh, you can never tell. Like all these killings that I heard about today, when I was in Gambia in the office of the president, I could not know about those things. And now when I see photos of the people who killed all these people, I worked with them, these soldiers. I used to see them at State House. But you will have no idea that they would do such a thing. So when you know him, you will see Jammeh the philanthropist. You will see somebody who will try to be nice to everyone. But again, somebody who will not hesitate to fire people from their job. But you will not see that killer part of Jammeh in the office. You will see a man in a white gown, you know, behind a desk, sitting there working on files, giving executive directives and, you know, giving us assignments. Sometimes somebody would write to the office and they say they're sick and they're trying to get treatment for £5,000, for instance, to go to the UK, and Jammeh would approve it. So that's the part that you would see when you're close to him. And then when you're a little bit far, because remember, it's a dictatorship, the flow of information does not happen. Everything we see on TV, he's a frontpiece, he gave scholarship, he gave money, he gave rice, he gave sugar. And then when you're far from him, away from him, that's when you see all this other side of Jammeh, the brutal killer that he is.
Fatou Camara is the former press secretary for Yahya Jammeh. She spoke with me from Georgia. The Ugandan People's Defense Forces, or UPDF, has announced the disappearance of Sultan Makenga, leader of the notorious M23 rebels from the Democratic Republic of Congo. The rebel leader was under UPDF's guard at a secret location in the Ugandan capital, Kampala. 2 weeks ago, the Ugandan government similarly issued a statement saying that M23 rebels who had been housed at a military training school had been quietly escaping. For reaction, I reached Brigadier Richard Karemire, spokesman for the UPDF.
The M23 problem, as you know it very well, has been on our hands since 2013, and our hope was that through the Nairobi Declaration of 2013, this problem would be solved between the two parties, mainly the M23 and the government in Kinshasa. It has not been the case. True, since the 14th of January, he has been missing. So we don't know where he is at the moment. We can't say for sure.
Some people are saying this has a very significant security implication for the government in Kinshasa. Are you in touch with the government in Kinshasa to tell them about the latest development? And is there any investigation by the UPDF to ascertain his whereabouts?
No, we are not doing any investigation. We share this information immediately with our DRC colleagues. They even sent a delegation over to Uganda, which had great discussions with our chief of defense forces. They were even given opportunity to visit behind the camp where the M23 are accommodated.
2 weeks ago, the Ugandan government issued a statement saying that M23 rebels who had been cantoned at Bihanga military training camp had been quietly escaping. Are you aware of this?
Yes, I am very, very aware of that. That's the same time also when their commander, Colonel Makenga, went missing. Yeah, we are aware of that. We are aware, and the DRC government as well is aware of that.
Some Ugandan critics of the UPDF are saying that this shows that the UPDF either is not serious about helping the government in Kinshasa to fight these rebels or to finish them, or that the UPDF is incompetent. Their words, not mine. What do you say to that?
No. UPDF have always been very, very serious. The whole world, particularly the African continent, knows the issue of seriousness link it to the two parties, the Nairobi Declaration, that is the DRC government and the M23. UPDF was never a party to that declaration.
Is the UPDF cooperating with the with its counterpart in Kinshasa to talk about some of these happenings in Uganda, which has a security implication for the country next door?
Absolutely. We have always had bilateral talks between ourselves and the DRC parties, and this matter has always been on the agenda of our discussion. But what the world should really know is that these M23 ex-combatants are not in any prison. So the Uganda, the UPDF, really, when is being, how have they escaped? They are not in our custody, please.
Does the UPDF know how they escaped from under its own noses?
These people are free. They are free to move out and go wherever they want. In fact, some of them have even secured the jobs. In the prison, you're expected to conduct a parade every evening. Parade early in the morning to ascertain who is around and who is not, who is sick, who is in whatever state. But in a case where these M33 combatants are not really in a prison, this is really expecting too much from the UPDF.
Brigadier Richard Karimire is the spokesman for the Ugandan People's Defense Forces, or UPDF. He spoke with me from Kampala. A secondary school in Somaliland has gained a reputation for sending its students to elite universities in America. But U.S. President Donald Trump's temporary ban on visas from Somalia and six other Muslim-majority countries has thrown the dozens of students' educational futures into uncertainty. For VOA, Jason Pattingkin reports from the Somaliland capital, Hargeisa.
19-year-old Shukri Ahmed Ali of the Abarso School of Science and Technology was ecstatic when she received a letter of acceptance in December to the elite Wellesley College in the American state of Massachusetts. But the native of Somaliland in the northwest of Somalia worries she will not be able to attend Wellesley later this year due to the temporary visa ban announced last week against Somalis and citizens of six other Muslim-majority countries.
If Donald Trump extends the 90-day ban, I might not be able to get into the U.S. because Somalia is part of the seventh country that he banned.
Dozens of Ali's classmates from the Abarso School feel the same uncertainty. More than 17,000 university and graduate students from the seven banned countries attended school in the United States last school year, according to the Institute of International Education. The ban has sparked some confusion about who is allowed into America and who is not. The White House has said it may extend the ban or blacklist additional countries. On Friday, a federal judge issued a temporary hold on the ban, which the U.S. president has vowed to overturn. The Trump administration says the ban is meant to protect Americans from foreign terrorists, but critics say it targets Muslims, an allegation Homeland Security Chief John Kelly denied at a news conference this past week. Kelly added that his agency's mission, quote, is to safeguard the American people, our homeland, our values, end quote. Abarso headmaster James Linville says he has eight students, including Ali, accepted to attend American universities, plus about 45 currently studying in American preparatory schools and universities.
We are advising them very strongly not to leave the country, not to come home during the summers, and that can be tough. Some of them are graduating from high school in the U.S. this year, and they've been accepted to continue at U.S. colleges. And so we still haven't quite figured out if they'll be able to transfer their visa.
Linville also worries about a dozen of Abarso students who have applied to attend college in the U.S., but still are waiting to hear back.
We're not sure if, you know, maybe those applications will be affected since the 90-day period will end after they hear back from their schools. I think from the perspective of some of the universities where they've applied to, maybe it seems like more of a risk to accept them, knowing that it's possible that they won't be able to come.
Abarso has received more than $1 million in funding from the U.S. government and regularly feeds Somali students to top American schools like Harvard, Yale, and others.
These are students who, when they finish their college education and return to Somaliland, they'll be among the most educated people in the country, and they'll be in a great position to help develop Somaliland and help be part of the next generation of Somali leaders. to have those people in the future leading countries that are important to the U.S. strategically and in terms of security, I think that's a very good situation for everyone.
Ali applied to Wellesley after studying as an exchange student in a Massachusetts high school.
I visited there when I was in the U.S. last year, and I liked their neuroscience department, and the campus was really beautiful. So my plans are to attend Wellesley College, study neuroscience, and then when I finish my education, come back to Somaliland and start the hospital.
She says despite the ban in the U.S., she still wants to go to America to study.
I feel like majority of the Americans are supporting us. We as Abarsi students are coming to the U.S. to get an education, and we are not terrorists. And the only reason we want to come there is to get an education that we could use to help our country and our community.
As Trump's order goes to the courts, students like Ali hope to continue their studies in America as planned. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Hargeisa.
In a rare public appearance, Cameroonian President Paul Biya paid homage to four top military officers killed in a helicopter crash last month and urged the country to persevere in its fight against Boko Haram militants. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka has more from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Cameroon's top general in the war against Boko Haram, Jacob Kodjé, was among the four officers killed when a helicopter went down on January 23. An investigation into the crash is underway. At a memorial service for the officers Friday, President Paul Biya said Boko Haram's firepower has been greatly reduced, but the war is far from over.
Soyons un, restons unis.
He says Cameroonians should solidly be united and remember all those who have died as a result of Boko Haram atrocities. He says the grief should reinforce their determination to continue the battle with the barbaric group. He says the blood of all soldiers who have died while defending Cameroon should prompt the entire nation to participate. Cameroon's Ministry of Defense says close to 200 soldiers have lost their lives in the war. The president pledged to take care of the families of fallen soldiers but did not give details. An estimated 2,000 civilians in Cameroon have been killed and hundreds of thousands more displaced since 2013 when Boko Haram expanded its insurgency from northeast Nigeria into Cameroon. Cameroon's military partnered with Nigeria and other regional armies. In the past year, those forces have succeeded in pushing Boko Haram out of much of the territory it once occupied, but suicide bombings have continued. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The Japanese government is providing more than $22 million for humanitarian assistance in South Sudan. It is also for rebuilding institutions as the country tries to recover from the conflict. A Japanese embassy official says its government will work with humanitarian agencies to implement development projects and provide aid to the hundreds of thousands of internally displaced persons, or IDPs. For VOA, Nabil Biagio reports from the South Sudanese capital, Juba.
The $22.4 million donation was announced yesterday at the Japanese embassy in Juba. Koji Ito, who runs cooperation and economic affairs at the embassy, says the money should provide food aid and health care for the displaced.
The immense needs of humanitarian assistance, such as food distribution, nutritional care, health care services, are there, but we are also trying to assist institutionally and also in terms of economic livelihoods of the citizens.
Ito says Japan will also help with capacity building.
For example, projects for establishing state revenue authority, which is going to help revenue collection of each of the states so that people in the region will have a government that is reliable to deliver public service. We also have e-visa application to South Sudan's migrants to South Sudan, so that the system is going to be upgraded and can be better monitored. We also have peace dialogue among the women groups, which is also in line with the national dialogue announcement that the president made in December.
Ito says the money will also help foster peace dialogue among women's groups, which he says is in line with the national dialogue President Salva Kiir announced in December. And some of the money will facilitate the work of ceasefire monitors in South Sudan. Ito says years of violence has destroyed much of South Sudan. He says it is not unlike what happened to Japan when it saw its infrastructure and institutions destroyed during World War II. He says his government can share with South Sudan its experience of post-war reconstruction.
Japan rebuilt itself from the post-war rubbles, and we have a strong emotional attachment to the situation of South Sudan, especially with the presence of the peacekeepers. We would like to accompany the peace-building efforts with concrete actions of humanitarian and reconstruction effort.
Like South Sudan, Japan also needed the help of its partners to rebuild after the war.
Japan did not come up by itself. We had immense help from international partners, and we, in collaboration with these generous donors, people in Japan started to realize that it is their time to rebuild their livelihoods. And I believe that this batch of funds, however little, would be utilized to the maximum extent so that South Sudanese people will restore their life.
A Juba resident who did not want to be identified for fear of repercussions says while Japan's donation is a noble gesture, he is skeptical that the South Sudan government will use it for the right purposes.
That was not the first time that money was donated to South Sudan, but still up to now there was no improvement which was met by the government. I'm afraid they're wasting money for no reason, especially some of the ministers, they used to sleep in these big hotels, and which they normally waste a lot of the government resources. And the government should have to use this money for improving infrastructures and then social services for citizens of South Sudan.
Another Juba resident, John Lowe, says the donation by Japan's government should be used to help the tens of thousands of IDPs, including those in his home county of Kejukeji.
Our parents are now in refugees. This money should be taken there to help them, and country will be in peace. With that peace, we'll find that people are running from their country. And that money actually to be able to develop hospitals, schools. Actually, let me give, for example, in Kejukeji. Kejukejians right now, they are leaving the place due to what insecurity. And if government put more effort into it, I think that they can solve the issue.
Japan also gave $13 million to assist South Sudanese refugees in Uganda, Ethiopia, and Kenya. The Japanese embassy in Juba has given $189 million to South Sudan since the fighting erupted in December 2013. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth look at the northern Nigeria-based terrorist group Boko Haram. The militant group has targeted both Muslims and Christians, killing more than 20,000 people since 2009. VOA has exclusively obtained secret video shot by Boko Haram that identifies its operatives committing acts of terror. We'll discuss the violent organization on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In the Africa Cup of Nations, seven-time winners Egypt will face Cameroon, who have four wins under their belt in Sunday's Africa Cup of Nations final, the third time the sides have met in the final. Egypt have won their two previous meetings in the final in 1986 and 2008. Egypt will be attempting to win the fourth consecutive Africa Cup of Nations in which they have competed. The Pharaohs, among the tournament's favorites from the outset in Gabon, were victorious in 2006, 2008 and 2010 before failing to qualify for the next three editions in 2012, 2013 and 2015. Underdogs Cameroon have upset the odds to reach the final, beating much-fancied Ghana in the last four. Seven-time winners Egypt earned their place in a record equaling ninth African Cup of Nations final by beating Burkina Faso 4-3 on penalties following a 1-1 semi-final draw. On Saturday, Alain Traoré's stunning late free kick defeated Ghana and sealed the third place in the Africa Cup of Nations for Burkina Faso. From the right of the 18-yard box, Traoré hammered the left-footed effort into the top corner of the net. It sent Ghana to fourth place for the third time in the past four tournaments. It was a measure of consolation for Burkina, who were denied a place in the final by a penalty shootout defeat by Egypt. Turning to athletics, Jepchirui Kirwa of Bahrain and Callum Hawkins of Great Britain notched convincing victories at the 71st edition of the Kagawa Maragame Half Marathon on Sunday. Kirwa, the pre-race favorite, clocked 1 hour 8 minutes and 7 seconds to win by 20 seconds, while Hawkins clocked 1 hour to win by nearly a minute. With Flanagan's late hour withdrawal, Jepchirui, the Olympic marathon silver medalist, who won this race last year, became the overwhelming favorite. She pushed the pace aggressively from the start, opening with a 15.35 fast 5-kilometer split, 3 seconds faster than Florence Kiplagat's opening stretch in her 1-hour world record run, to build a 30-second lead over Amy Craig of the US, who was running a distant second. But Jepchirui was never threatened in her pursuit to follow 2012 Olympic marathon champion Tichy Galana, who won in Marugame in 2012 and 2013 as a back-to-back winner. Jepchirui will return to Japan to run the Nagoya Women's Marathon in March, where she will be targeting a third successive victory. Meanwhile, Hawkins was even more dominant in the men's race, but unlike Jepchirui, he chose to begin in a much more cautious fashion. The 24-year-old Briton stopped the clock at 60 minutes even, just missing out on becoming the fourth runner to crack the one-hour barrier in this race after Mekugu Mogusu, Paul Kuria and Zane Robertson. His performance elevated him to number two on the UK all-time list behind Mo Farah. Finally, organizers of the EDP Lisbon Half Marathon have announced that Olympic marathon champion Jemina Samgong, world marathon champion Mara Dibaba, and Olympic 5,000-meter champion Vivian Chiruyot will line up against one another at the IAAF Gold Label Road Race on March 19th. Samgong, who finished second in Lisbon in 2014, will return to the Portuguese capital with the aim of improving her personal best, set 2 months before her victory at the 2016 London Marathon. She will be up against fellow Kenyan Cheruiyot, who won last year's Great South Run on her half-marathon debut, just 1 month after taking 5,000-meter gold and 10,000-meter silver at the Rio 2016 Olympic Games. Dibaba, who has a half-marathon personal best of 1 hour, 7 minutes and 13 seconds, will also be in the field. The fastest in the women's race, though, is Ethiopia's Genet Yaleo. The men's field doesn't contain any global champions, but it boasts three men with sub 60 minutes personal bests. James Mwangi is perhaps the most exciting prospect, The Kenyan made his half marathon debut last year with a 59.12 victory in Milan. He followed it up by winning a high quality race in Copenhagen, improving his lifetime best 59.07. Eritrea's 2014 Africa 10,000 meter champion Nguse Amlosom has twice won the Lisbon Rock and Roll Half Marathon, but this will be his first appearance at the other half marathon in the Portuguese capital. Simon Shiprod set his personal best of 59.20 back in 2013 and finished sixth at last year's IAAF World Half Marathon Championships. Others in the men's field include Kenya's Emmanuel Kipsang, Eritrea's Yohannes Gebragagish, and Zimbabwe's Cuthbert Nyasango. 2014 Africa Cross Country Champion Leonard Basoton and 2014 World Under 20 10,000 meter bronze medalist Nicholas Kisombei will both be making their half marathon debut. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Now love, I just see for your eyes, I give all that you need and I won't think twice, it's double six when I throw the dice, oh girl, I'm loving your size, there is no deceiving, with you girl I'm winning, the way you do the things you do, you make me scream what I'm feeling, oh girl you give me the healing, I'm down for your feeling, the way you do the things you do, you make me scream what I'm feeling. I'm so in love with you, baby. Oh, anything you want me to, baby. Oh, I still wanna give you to, baby. Baby, dance to my sukus. Then go put this love on you. Yeah, don't go low. Don't go low, yeah, don't go low. Don't go low. Don't go low, yeah, don't go low. Don't go low, yeah, don't go low. Don't go low.
Jumbo low, up I'm gonna get today, my baby. Then go no, say me and you will not play, my baby. Then go say anything where they wanna say, my baby. We go be anything that we wanna be. I'm in love with you, baby girl, I'm in love with you. Wanna dance with you, baby girl, wanna dance with you. Baby, click at that, if I get on a demon, my own. Baby, dance to my sukus, baby, muna gig and be.
Jumbolo, yeah, jumbolo, 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 ah, ah, jumbolo, baby, yeah, jumbolo, 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 yeah, jumbolo, jumbolo,
ah, ah, my sweetie potato, ah, jumbolo, my sweetie potato,
of course.
Yeah.
see a woman with a bishop. You don't know. Are you ready now? Baby girl, show them. Show them. Mr. Flavor Cordial!
Yeah.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Despite a massive lobbying activity, the African Union at its summit meeting recently in Addis Ababa found some backbone to adopt by consensus a resolution calling on African states to proceed to a massive withdrawal from the International Criminal Court, ICC. This is another attempt by the African Union to indicate its displeasure with the performance of the ICC in The Hague. Of course, supporters of the ICC were quick to point out that not all African states were willing to support the withdrawal from the ICC, pointing out to reservation by Nigeria and Senegal. But this is not new. In the United States, there is a practice where from time to time you have a sense of Congress resolution which does not bind the administration, but represent an opinion of how the Congress feels. And sooner or later, this will influence policy formulation by the administration. Equally, what we saw last week in the summit and in Addis Ababa is an expression of what Africa thinks about the ICC. It may be that for constitutional and practical reasons, African states may have different way of expressing their view on this resolution. So those who support the ICC should not take any comfort in the fact that you will find African states who say they are not at this time prepared to withdraw. Or even more worrying to some, that from time to time African politicians or states might shout out that they will take this or that person before the ICC. What has often been forgotten by those who criticize the African views on the ICC is that Africa as a whole were the main supporters of the creation of the ICC. In fact, one-third of the members of the ICC are African states. The question that the Africans have had is not the essence or the concept of the ICC, but the way it is performing at the moment. And therefore, it is also significant that the decision which was taken last week in Addis Ababa also called for the reform of the ICC. Throughout Africa's criticism of the ICC, nothing has been done by the ICC to reform itself. Instead, it has spent so much time and energy to split African opinion, to say that what you have about the criticisms are just quote-unquote African politics. There are also suggestions being made by some African states that the African Union should form its own criminal court to deal with the matter of impunity. But this may not be the best option. The better option would be still for a reform ICC. The problem with the ICC today is that it has allowed itself to be managed by a minority of states, and even some states who have not fully embraced the Rome Treaty. So this is where the focus should be, not to try to divide Africa, but to spend more time to reform the ICC. If this is done, African states will warmly participate fully in the ICC. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky. We say thanks for joining us, and remember, as the elders say, the chicken that digs for food will not sleep hungry. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Joaquin Archivaldo Guzman Loera, known by various aliases, including El Chapo, 59, arrived in the United States on January 19th, following his extradition from Mexico. He was arraigned the following day on a 17-count superseding indictment before U.S. Magistrate Judge James Orenstein in federal court in Brooklyn. Following his extradition to the United States on related charges filed in the Western District of Texas and Southern District of California, the Mexican government approved a request by the United States to proceed with prosecution on the charges filed in the Eastern District of New York on May 11, 2016. The indictment alleges that between January 1989 and December 2014, Guzman Loera led a continuing criminal enterprise responsible for importing into the United States and distributing massive amounts of illegal narcotics and conspiring to murder persons who posed a threat to Guzman Loera's narcotics enterprise. Guzman Loera is also charged with using firearms in relation to his drug trafficking and money laundering relating to the bulk smuggling from the United States to Mexico of more than $14 billion in cash proceeds from narcotics sales throughout the United States. As part of this investigation, nearly 200,000 kilograms of cocaine linked to the Sinaloa cartel have been seized. The indictment seeks forfeiture of more than $14 billion in drug proceeds and illicit profits. This extradition is a tremendous victory for the citizens of Mexico and of the United States, said DEA Acting Administrator Rosenberg. Two principles stand out. No one is above the law, and we simply do not quit in the pursuit of justice.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.